Welcome back to the reading and commentary on the book Simplicity Parenting with me, Kim John Payne, the author. We're in chapter one. This will be our sixth session in chapter one. And in this section, we go a little further into what is titled or subtitled The Process, Getting Started. So let's just dive into the text. In terms of the areas to change, I usually see two categories: what is important and what is doable. What seems the most important is usually not. What is the most doable is the place to begin. If you do enough that is doable, you will get to the important, and your motivation will be fueled by your success. So often we need to find our way to a goal by identifying and discarding what that vision is not. Family is not disparate relationships between individuals and machines in separate rooms of a house. Childhood is not a race to accumulate all the consumer goods and stresses of adulthood in record time. Simplification signals a change and makes room for transformation. It's a stripping away that invites clarity. Quite simply, simplification signals a change, a realignment of our hopes and our everyday lives. Again, quite simply, simplification signals a change, a realignment of our hopes and our everyday lives. Reacquainted with their dreams for their family, parents and I would talk about how a simplification regime might help them change course, how simplifying might make room for a shift, a realignment of their hopes with their everyday lives. It'd be great if a simplification involved nothing more than backing up a dumpster to the house and discarding piles of stuff. Unfortunately, there's more to it. Children can be overloaded with more than just the physical things bulging out of their cupboards. But as you'll see, there are simple tossing out or whittling down at each level. Parents and I would discuss the four levels of simplification: the environment, rhythm, schedules, and filtering out the adult world. We would touch on all of them and discuss which aspects of the regime felt most doable. Sometimes I was surprised. Some parents would want to dive into the more difficult arenas of scheduling and filtering out the adult world right away, while other parents, like Marie's, would cautiously express a willingness to see a few less toys around the house. Often, a modest goal was an instinctual first step towards something larger. Somehow parents know where to begin to create the necessary space in their intentions and in their lives for a transformation. Marie's parents chose to address Marie's home environment first, as I'll recommend you do too. Her story shows that by starting with the doable, we can pave the way for broader changes. Marie was a bright, energetic 5-year-old beginning kindergarten when I first met her parents. She'd had a series of babysitters who came to the home, all of whom had trouble controlling her. Marie was hard work, if you will, very active, unfocused, with clear attention difficulties. Just before kindergarten, Marie's parents had to put her in a daycare centre, from which, after a couple of months, she was actually asked to leave. Marie's parents were very nice people, actually, and they were clearly trying to do their best for their daughter. They were both working professionals who led very busy, hectic lives. It had been difficult to even find the time for us to sit down together. At that initial meeting, I could see how concerned and defeated they felt in the face of what they called Marie's already checkered career. Together, we began to work out a simplification regime for the family. Her parents decided to begin with the physical environment of their home, particularly simplifying Marie's room. If the average American child has around 150 toys, Marie's had at least double that number. Her room was packed with books, some on shelves, but many in towering piles. There were a few narrow passageways to and from her bed, carved between mountains of books and clothes and toys. Periodically, the parents assured me they would undertake an archaeological dig in the room to tidy up, only to see the chaos return within hours. Whether they are in bins, baskets, trunks, closets, piles, or heaps, the children's toys are usually the first focus. To the mountain of toys in their bedroom, we add the outlying piles from around the other places in the house. The accumulated whole is usually a remarkable sight, and not only the parents take this in, but they take it in fully, as well as myself. With a box of large black plastic trash bags at hand, we begin the work of cleaning up the area. I suggest that we put half the toys in the bag. Excellent. And then, actually half again. There are always some toys that parents are anxious to get rid of. They dive into the pile, searching with glee for the plastic exploding disasters, the ones that whir, talk, gyrate, detonate. Essentially, they're looking for ones that the grandparents or bachelor uncles have given. Shouldn't we keep these as insurance for grandmother's next visit? Are sometimes the comments. Chances are, I assure them, grandmother has no memory of the toy itself, only the joy she saw of when she was giving it. Chances are also good that the child has forgotten the toy too, or it has one or more pieces missing. In this way, we make a molehill out of a mountain, leaving for the child a mix of toys that they enjoy the most consistently and for the longest periods of time. Rarely are these favorite complex or motorized. Rarely do they do anything. They are just not the favorites. The toys that are too detailed or complicated, too fixed, so to speak, can rob a child of an imaginative experience. Dear nighttime toys can never disappear. Even if they're totally hideous, dear nighttime toys, those are non-negotiable. They're keepers. The remaining toys have to include a mixture of active toys, building, digging, construction toys, and more receptive toys like dollies and stuffed animals, toys that just receive. There can also be creative materials such as paints and crayons and some modelling substances like beeswax or clay. The toys with staying power are usually, not always, but pretty consistently, figures of some sort, either dolls or knights or stuffed animals, building toys, and scenes or dwellings of some sort into which the child loves to project his or her figures. And, by its very nature, thus, themselves. When we turn our attention to books, whittling the pile down to one or two of their current favourites, this can truly shock some parents who take pride in their children's love of reading. Quote, you know, Sarah reads 5 or 6 books at once, the parents might implore. Our purpose here is not to discourage reading. but to allow the child to really concentrate on and revel in whatever they are reading or doing at a given time. I remember Dylan, a very bright, talkative 8-year-old, who once started a conversation with this excited pronouncement. "You know what? I just totally finished number 16, the Magic Treehouse series, and I'm on the 4th Time Warp Trio, and I just got new Captain's Underpants." "Well," I said, "which one of those did you really enjoy?" Oh, I don't know," he said clearly, thinking my question was beside the point. They're all pretty much the same." So, with a few large baskets, we had culled Marie's toys way down. The remaining toys were a mix of favourites, the simpler, better dolls, building toys, cherished bedtime toys, some kitchen things, and a few play balls. Almost half of the toys that did not make the cut were thrown away because they were broken or had missing pieces. The rest we put in storage. The stored toys were the sort of toy library that a family could draw on from time to time to provide a replacement for one before taking another back and putting into storage. We did the same with books, packing and labelling the majority of them for storage, and leaving 5 or 6 favourites lined neatly up on Marie's bed. We didn't just take away toys. Actually, we carefully added some. In one basket, we put a stack of brightly coloured fabric pieces, some rope and clothespins. We also made sure Marie had a table her size, a large drawing pad, and a box of beeswax crayons. We gathered, washed, and unfolded an assortment of dress-up clothes, which we put in one empty basket. You might think Marie's first reaction to this kind of anti-Christmas would be a shock. Actually, not so. And I've seen this again and again. She didn't seem to notice or care that a good 3/4 of her toys and books had been removed. She was taken with the new space, with the freedom it seemed to afford. For days and days, she built houses with clothespins and cloth. She would build them and curl up inside them, pulling in a pillow and sometimes a book or a dolly. Every single day for a couple of weeks, she repeated this, and it seemed to be doing something for her that she really needed. She came to trust that she could build another the next day, that these were hers to make and to have. So each afternoon, after admiring the day's creation, Marie's mother and Marie would take them down, talk as they folded the cloths, unpinned the pins, and put the materials in their basket, ready for the next day's construction. This was just the first step in a simplification process that included several levels and unfolded over many months. Yet this first step, the change in Marie's room, signaled a kind of sea change, a new awareness that expanded through the house and through the days, through the space and time of daily life. This sea change was not just the result of tidying up. It was a conscious move, both practically and philosophically, towards a more rhythmic, predictable, and child-centered home life. By that, I don't mean that the home and everything done in it are oriented towards a child, but I do absolutely mean that the home and everything in it are not exclusively oriented towards an adult. A certain pace or volume of stuff may be tolerable for adults, while it is intolerable or problematic for kids. Children are such tactile beings. They live so fully in their senses that if they see something They'll also want to touch it, smell it, possibly eat it, throw it, feel what it's like on their heads, listen to it, sort it, probably submerge it in water or mud. This is entirely natural. Strap on their pith helmet and they're exploring the world. But imagine the sensory overload that can happen for a child when every surface, every drawer and closet is filled with stuff. So many choices and so much stimuli rob them of time and attention. Too much stuff deprives kids of leisure and the ability to explore their worlds deeply. Quite simply, too much stuff leads to too little time, too little depth in the way kids see and explore the world. Again, quite simply, too much stuff leads to too little time, too little depth in the way kids see and explore the world. Now, just a commentary briefly on that, because much of that reading was fairly self-explanatory. But, you know, I've got to say that it's true that a lot of parents will begin with simplifying stuff, you know, toys, books, and so on. It's been interesting since Simplicity Parenting book was published to see how many parents are now becoming genuinely concerned with filtering out the adult world with screens, phones, computers, iPads and the like. And what I've noticed in recent times is how many parents are actually, rather than beginning only with toys, will actually choose to begin with screens. And I've been surprised at that, because getting rid of screens and the kind of digital deluge that is coming into our homes, I can't help but feel that that's quite a challenge. That's difficult. It's become so ubiquitous. It's like the new normal to have so many screens, so much digital stuff coming into kids' lives. But actually, I've seen more and more parents start at that end, and not just with the decluttering of closets and books and toys. That's still probably the majority of parents who choose to start simplifying and decluttering with stuff. But things have changed a little since 2009, and I'm seeing a definite shift in what parents are doing. Also, I want to emphasize that it's not just the taking away. You probably heard that in the text, you know, the storage, the library that you can establish. But I've seen amazing just smiles and joy, particularly on young children's faces, when they return back to their bedrooms after this big clear out, and they see a real spade or a real hammer or a real little toolkit, or one mum and dad got a little leather tool belt for their child with lots of tools in it for her, which they figured she would really love, and she did. She totally loved it and got to work right away. My last point is that whilst this section I just read was oriented around younger children, you'll see in the reading coming up that this isn't exclusively for little kids. Over the years, I've noticed how this clear up and clean out has really helped tweens, like kids 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, and teenagers as well. I mean, really considering these four pillars of simplicity is super important, of course, for kids of all ages. However, I have seen countless numbers of parents work with their tweens and with their teens to clear up and clear out their spaces as well. And it's been welcomed, it's really worked well, and has given teenagers, just as much as little kids, a feeling of, I guess the only way I can describe it is of inner spaciousness that has a reflection in a more tidy, organized outer environment. Because our teenagers have a lot of clutter going on inside. You know, as I often say, their emotional life is like closed for renovation, right? It's like a reconstruction zone in there. And having an environment that is clean and clear and organized in their rooms, in a sense, feels like, okay, I've got the space out there to deal with all the clutter and reorganizing that I'm doing in here, in the emotional life as well. So there we have our next installment of chapter one in Simplicity Parenting, with these comments, which I sure hope have been helpful for you. Okay, bye-bye for now.